Hello and welcome to the Emergency Medicine Journal podcast for April 2024. I'm Rick Boddy, and for anyone who's new to the podcast, I'm the deputy editor at the Emergency Medicine Journal, and I'm an emergency physician working in Manchester in the UK.
And I'm Sarah Edwards, and I'm the social media editor, and I'm one of the senior editors of the Emergency Medicine Journal, and I am an emergency physician as well, and I'm working in Nottingham in the Midlands. So welcome.
So today we've got four papers for you. Two of them are about COVID-19. Then we move to staff retention, and we finish with my favourite topic of all time, the diagnosis of acute coronary syndromes. To get us started, we're going to talk a little bit about COVID-19 though. And Sarah, you've got a really interesting paper on racial and ethnic disparities in COVID-19 positivity and outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, we've not really talked about many COVID-19 papers for a little while, and I guess that probably reflects our clinical practice with, you know, COVID rates going up in the winter and then sort of trickling down now that we're the other side of the winter, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. I think it's safe to say, I don't know about for you, Rick, I'd be interested to hear, but the COVID-19 pandemic was probably one of the most significant clinical events for me. And when I was reading this paper, I was sort of reflecting back to my experience of early 2020, which is when this paper is set. And it's probably one of the most challenging and difficult bits of my career. I don't know about for you before we get into the paper, Rick.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that I have experienced any time like it during the whole of my career, especially during those first couple of waves when the care that we provided in the emergency department was just so different. We just had, in the first wave, patient after patient coming in with severe pneumonia. I certainly don't remember any time like it. So it's really important that we learn the lessons from it. We always said during the pandemic, we needed to learn from this. And then we kind of moved on and got busy. And it feels that we just need to take a little bit of time and stop and learn some of those lessons. And this paper and the next one give us a great opportunity to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you were saying in the introduction, this paper is looking at racial and ethnic disparities in COVID-19 positivity and outcomes among patients presenting to emergency departments during the first two pandemic waves in the United States. And the first author is Kozel et al. And essentially what they did was a retrospective study of patients who tested positive for COVID-19 during or 14 days prior to the index ED visit in 2020. This amazing piece of work covers the emergency care network, which has 155 emergency departments across 27 US states. And they were able to do some clever data core computering to match all the patients together and track what happened to them. So they looked at the early phase in March to June 2020 and that late phase in July to September 2020. So amazingly, Rick, would you believe they got 26,000 patients or just a little bit over that? And what they found was that 38% of them were non-Hispanic white, 29% were black, 20% were Hispanic Latino, 3% were Asian, and 10% were all others, with the median age of the patients being 56 years. Now, within the paper, and I suggest you go and read it, there's lots of incredible detailed data about, you know, diagnosis, times, things like that. But actually, probably some of the key outcomes from this paper was of those discharged from the emergency department, 47% had a subsequent hospitalisation in 30 days, with Hispanic or Latino patients having twice the odds of COVID-19 diagnosis than non-Hispanic white patients after adjusting for age, sex and comorbidities. I'm going to pause there for the results before I carry on, Rick. Any thoughts about that?
I think we're recognising that health inequalities are really stark nowadays, and it seems to be getting more and more stark. So I think this is straight away I'm intrigued because this is shining a light on some apparent health inequalities here with regard to COVID-19, which I think we kind of know about. You know, we've heard about these before, but this paper is really trying to quantify how big a problem that is.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it goes on to sort of cover some of the other key things, which is if you are Black, Asian, or from any other minority group, you are at higher odds of being diagnosed compared to non-Hispanic white patients with COVID-19. And it's clear from this paper with this very large data set that there is a higher likelihood of COVID-19 diagnosis in the Hispanic and Latino patients. Asian patients were at higher likelihood of subsequent hospitalisation compared with white patients. And these racial ethnic differences in COVID-19 were not clearly only apparent in the US, but, you know, it's some of the things that I remember working in a very ethnically diverse city during the first phase. And, you know, going forwards, we clearly need to be cognizant of this. And I think there's an accompanied commentary with this paper that's been written by three authors. And there's one line that I think just really sums up the challenges and the issues around that. And they say social distancing is a privilege, and that underscores the multifaceted nature of these disparities. And I think that probably relates to some of the findings that we have. And I think I hadn't quite articulated to myself that actually social distancing, which was hugely important in the early phases of COVID, you know, whole societies were closed down and changed overnight because of social distancing, that actually for lots of groups of people that social distancing was really challenging for lots of reasons. And I wonder whether that's an element within not only this commentary, but this paper highlights with groups from different ethnic minorities. Rick?
So, yeah, it's the findings are fascinating. The first thing we have to do in order to address health inequalities is recognise that they're there. And that this paper clearly shows us that they are there. And there's important racial and ethnic disparities in getting COVID-19 infection and in the outcomes once you get COVID-19 infection, depending on your ethnicity. The authors in the discussion have tried to speculate on what might have caused it. And I guess it's quite a complex issue to untangle, but they've speculated on some important things that might have led to these findings. For example, that more Black, Latino, Asian, and Native American people are employed in essential areas of the economy. And so if they're essential workers, they may have been having less opportunity to work from home. And therefore, because they're working in person, there's more person-to-person contact and more transmission. So they may have been at risk because of that. There may have been issues with multifamily homes. There may have been issues with structural racism in the health system, which might have caused unequal testing, for example. There's lots of different things that might have contributed to this. I think the important thing now is to move on from recognizing that we have a problem to trying to do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just to, you know, going forward to, you know, when I'm next working within the emergency department, it's recognizing that there is a huge disparity and diversity amongst the populations that we often serve. And it's complex, it's not easy. And we've got to try and do the best that we can for patients, particularly in this context of COVID-19, to give them the best chance that they can.
Absolutely. I guess looking forward as well, we have to be intersectional about this, right? We have to think about the relationships. I talked about some factors that might have explained the findings that the authors have identified. But it's really important to think about socioeconomic deprivation, how that relates to this, you know, housing conditions. There's all sorts of other things that we need to think about together with this that need to be explored in order to address this so that, you know, we don't get these same outcomes. And you know what? COVID is just one issue, isn't it? If the outcomes are this bad when we have a pandemic, actually, they're probably just as bad for other conditions outside the context of a pandemic.
Absolutely. And, you know, we already know that there's disparities across, you know, your favourite topic about ACS and the management of that, you know, on, you know, ethnicity, on gender and how that's interpreted, how that's diagnosed. So complex issues. And I think, you know, I think medicine or diagnoses or conditions are less black or white these days. There's so much impact in them, and I think it's just not as simple as perhaps we once thought.
Absolutely. Sticking with the COVID theme, I've taken a look at another paper reporting on a big study from Canada. So it was a retrospective observational study looking at characteristics and outcomes of patients with COVID-19 who returned to the emergency department. So there were 47 emergency departments involved in this study. It took data from 47 emergency departments between the 1st of March 2020 and March 2022. And the authors here had aimed to have a look at the predictors of a return visit in patients who'd attended with COVID-19. So your study was big, Sarah, but this one had 39,800 patients with COVID-19 in it. So an incredible number. And there were nearly 45,000 COVID-19 related emergency department visits. So it gives them fantastic statistical power to look at the sort of factors that might predict repeat attendance versus those who might go home and they don't come back to the emergency department. So, Sarah, I'm going to ask you, and I'm going to put you on the spot. What do you think would be the factors that most predict whether a patient with COVID-19 coming to the ED would reattend after they've been discharged?
I'm always going to say comorbidities. I think that's a safe bet. Maybe if you're older, younger, maybe. Ethnicity, I'm not sure if this study actually looked at ethnicity, but that might be a factor. So those are some of the things that are shouting out at me.
Yeah, those are pretty good guesses, actually. So age was certainly a factor. The older you get, the more likely you are to reattend. And this is in their multivariable analysis. So they took account of all the different factors. And then when you weighed them together, you know, taking account of everything else, age was still predictive. Now, interestingly, pregnancy was quite a strong predictor of repeat attendance. Mm. So the odds ratio for pregnancy was 1.86. I think we all recognize that pregnancy was a risk factor, made you high risk with COVID-19. This study certainly showed that. The presence of comorbidities, you were absolutely right, is a predictor. Cancer was a particular one. In fact, the odds ratio for cancer was 2.01. Obesity, even more of a predictor, 2.18. And then we've got things like substance use, higher temperature, and then the severity of disease, which on arrival, I guess that's not so much of a surprise. Women were less likely to return to the emergency department. And no surprise on this one, if you've been fully vaccinated or boosted, you were far less likely to reattend the emergency department. So I think these findings just give us some information about the patients we might need to really keep an eye out for when we're discharging them with COVID-19. And I guess we can extrapolate that to other infectious diseases. These findings are likely to apply to other infectious diseases. But any of that come as a surprise to you, Sarah?
I think the one that stands out, I can sort of understand lots of them, but it's the higher temperature one I thought was really interesting, because actually, you know, we know generally, and the evidence supports, like, you know, temperature, high temperatures actually are not often associated with morbidity and mortality. I suppose this doesn't mean mortality. I suppose this is a morbidity bit about it, I suppose, and a return. It doesn't necessarily mean about the outcomes, but that was probably a little bit of a surprise. The others don't surprise me, because cancer, obesity, organ transplant, substance abuse, there's probably an element of immunosuppression from a variety of mechanisms there. But yeah, it was the higher temperature that I think surprised me. And it's great to know that, you know, women don't return as much as men.
Yeah, but having seen that, I guess that really does show you how important pregnancy is as a risk factor, because women in general are less likely, and yet pregnancy was such a risk factor.
So I think it's definitely watch this space. I think, you know, now we're sort of 4 years since the beginning of the pandemic, which is just unfathomable how time has gone on. But I guess I would imagine in the next sort of 2, 3, 4 years, with time, with reflection, with the opportunity to actually stop and get that data, I think we'll probably be having more papers like this in all journals coming out with that, those big data sets, trying to understand what actually happened.
Very true. So moving on, we're going to come away from COVID-19, and we're going to have a look at another very important issue in emergency medicine, which is staff retention. We have a big problem with staff leaving emergency medicine, I think, and especially in the UK. And you've had a look at a study from Joe Daniels, senior author Ed Carlton, looking at barriers and opportunities to improve working conditions and staff retention.
Yeah, I think staff retention is a problem. And I think it just doesn't only apply to emergency medicine, but it's probably healthcare in general. And this paper is called Perceived Barriers and Opportunities to Improve Working Conditions and Staff Retention in Emergency Departments, a qualitative study. So like chest pain is Rick's favourite topic. Mine generally is any qualitative work and study, which is why you often hear me talking about them, because I think it's really interesting. I love understanding people's thoughts and where they're coming from and trying to really get deep and understand those thoughts and feelings. So in a sort of typical qualitative approach, this group got some doctors, nurses, advanced care practitioners of all grades, all seniorities and professional backgrounds across the UK. They did some snowball recruitment, and this was used using social media and the Royal College of Emergency Medicine communication channels. They did a typical sort of semi-structured topic guide to explore difficulties in the work environment, thinking about impact of these difficulties, barriers, priorities for change, and thus forth. So of the 116 clinical staff that were interested in getting involved, 33 took part, and they were predominantly British, which is not a surprise. It's been done in the UK. Mostly female, 73%, and 61% were doctors. Any surprises there so far, Rick, for you?
No, seems pretty representative. I mean, 73% female. I mean, I think our workforce is predominantly female now at, you know, certainly at junior levels. So I guess that doesn't actually, you know, it seems pretty representative.
Yeah, absolutely. So overall, they found four themes that came out of all these conversations. So they were around culture of blame and negativity, untenable working environments, compromised leadership, and striving for support. And if we talk about the first topic, which is around the culture of blame and negativity, people reported that the work environment often felt unsupported and toxic at times. And one of the participants said, "You worry about making a mistake. And if you did make a mistake, who would have your back?" This, you know, not unsurprisingly, leads into a very untenable work environment, which is obviously the second theme. And there was significant concerns around care being felt to be compromised and staff being felt undervalued due to poor facilities for them. And on the theme of sort of comprised leadership, for example, participants felt that clinical leads in the ED were responsible for setting the tone and culture and behaviour in the ED, leading by example. One of the comments within the paper that struck me was, "You lead by example as well. So if your consultant in charge is not taking a break, you feel like you can't ask to take a break. It's the same with the nurses. If the nurse in charge is not taking a break, then a lot of junior nurses won't come and ask for a break to be taken because they're guided by the leadership, aren't you?"
Well, that's fascinating, isn't it? Because coming through in my career, I always had this perception that, you know, I need to work really hard. I've got patients waiting. I can't justify taking a break. And this shows that actually, no, now as a consultant in the emergency department and the leader, if I was to continue doing that, one, I'd be shattered. But two, it's really not great as a role modeling exercise for the junior staff that are working with me. So just emphasizes the importance of making sure that we do look after ourselves. We're going to look after the patients well. We have to look after ourselves, and we have to make sure as leaders that the junior staff that we are supervising and mentoring are looking after themselves too.
Yeah. And the last one, you know, they all read sad and there's lots of learning, but I think this one really saddens me, is about striving for support, with the final theme really trying to encompass the concern raised by participants regarding well-being, staff support, barriers to accessing this, for example. There are two quotes that I'm taking directly out of the paper, and I think it'll be interesting to hear your thoughts. The first one is from a nurse. I think for me, it still feels like a bit of stigma about saying I'm struggling with what I should do next. And then from a consultant, there's nowhere I can express how I am feeling or even understand how I am feeling. I think that's phenomenally sad that people don't feel able to express how they're feeling, that they're having a difficult time, for people that are working at the sharp end of healthcare. That's hugely unpredictable. That's hugely stressful. That is life-changing. That they can't express how they feel is just heartbreaking to hear. It's not a surprise, but it's utterly heartbreaking. I mean, Rick, what do you think? You are a leader.
I completely agree with you, Sarah. I think it just shows how we've got to make sure that we've got systems that allow us to listen to our staff and to make people feel that they have channels to communicate with the leadership, that they will be listened to, and that some of the things that can be changed will be changed, I guess that's important. We put a lot of work into wellbeing. We've got a consultant working with us now called Laura Howard, who did a lot of work on wellbeing and had some initiatives like the ED Spa, having a dedicated space for staff to have a time out and recognizing the importance of listening to each other and having compassion, not just for our patients, but for each other. Because things are tough, as you can see from some of those quotes. And we absolutely need to be able to talk to each other. People need to feel that it's psychologically safe to express what they're feeling and the frustrations they're having.
Yeah, and I think this study, which of course was with, you know, the whole multidisciplinary team of the emergency department, you know, reflects the within the United Kingdom, there's the Emergency Medicine Training Association, and they do a survey every year of trainees within emergency medicine, and, you know, burnout and being unable to express how you're feeling and things like that features heavily within that survey. And, you know, work done within the US, for example, you know, burnout rates in emergency medicine physicians, clinicians of any background is huge. Ultimately, this paper concludes in there's a lot of learning from the work that they've done. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, you know, to train the leaders of the future to be compassionate, to be holistic, to, you know, be the leaders of the future that people can relate to and be civil to. And I think, you know, more work needs to continue to be done about this, because until we've got the data, nothing can change.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know, I, on this paper, there's one actual thing that I'd like to pick up on that is a very easy thing that I think we can all address. And it's a quote from one of the doctors that was interviewed, which was, "You very rarely get anyone saying that was a good job." And that is something we can all act on straight away, because all of us, no matter our seniority, can say to our colleagues, "You know what? I think you did really well there." And we can point out what went well, because I think that makes a difference to people, just feeling recognised and valued.
Absolutely. You know, it's the little things that often can make the biggest difference.
It is indeed. That brings us on to the last paper that we're going to cover today. And it's my favourite topic, as I said at the beginning. It's acute coronary syndromes. And not only that, it's an area of current focus for me, which is pre-hospital point of care troponin testing. So everybody who works in an emergency department knows what a big problem chest pain is. You probably groan when you think about it, because we're so used to seeing patients with suspected acute coronary syndromes in our practice. In the hospital, in the EDs, we've made great advances, haven't we? We're now able to use high sensitivity troponin and decision aids to rapidly rule in and rule out acute coronary syndromes, allowing the patients who are well to go home within hours and getting treatment for the ones who need it. Well, point of care testing is now advanced, and we're able to get troponin measurements with decent sensitivity at the point of care, which means that we could move some of the diagnostics to the pre-hospital environment. And Jamie Cooper and colleagues, which included me actually, as a kind of external author on this one, ran a study. And this was called Access. So in the Access study, paramedics went out and recruited patients who had suspected cardiac chest pain when they were receiving an emergency ambulance response. They took blood from the patients and then they collected data for decision aids. And they looked at the accuracy of those decision aids. Now, Jamie had already published the main findings from this study, which looked at the accuracy of the heart score with a point of care assay called Samsung Lab Geo. And that's it's not a high sensitivity test. But when it was used with a heart score, the hope was it might be really sensitive and be able to rule out acute coronary syndromes. It wasn't quite sensitive enough. So the sensitivity was, I think, 87% in that study, which was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine. Now, moving on, Jamie's looking at a subgroup of the data where they had data for TMAX, the troponin-only Manchester acute coronary syndromes decision aid, which we use in Manchester. And that's like the heart score, has just seven simple questions, and you can rule in or rule out an acute coronary syndrome. And they use this with a troponin test that's actually based in a lab. So the lab, the blood samples were taken to the lab in the hospital and tested using a high sensitivity troponin test. Now you might say, well, that makes it not very generalizable, but we do now have point of care tests that are as good as lab tests. So it's showing us the art of the possible when we use a high sensitivity point of care test. There were 247 patients in the study, and they've looked at a number of decision aids. I'll keep my summary a little bit short and focused on the two decision aids that use troponin tests. So that's TMAX and the heart score. Now, the heart score had a sensitivity of, it depends on the cutoff that you use. So if you use a heart score of less than or equal to 3, you manage to get a sensitivity of 92.5%. So that's a bit better than in the original paper. And the negative predictive value is 95.3%. So you probably wouldn't want to leave someone at home with that. That's the way we originally used the heart score, because there's still a 4.7% chance of the patient having a myocardial infarction or having a cardiac death within the next 30 days. If you modified the heart score so that you sort of set the troponin cutoff really, really low, and anyone above that you would take to the hospital, then you get 100% sensitivity. So that was much better. And about 16% of patients could have been ruled out using that. I was pleased to see TMAX validated in this, of course, because we've been involved with that. And TMAX had 100% sensitivity as well. It got slightly more patients identified as low risk. So it's 20% of all of the patients were very low risk and could have been left at the scene, and no missed diagnoses. So bottom line there is, looks like a modified heart score and TMAX could allow you to rule out myocardial infarction with really good sensitivity. It's the first study, apart from my Presto study, to look at TMAX. We found really good sensitivity for TMAX in the Presto study. And this is the first sort of external look at that I'm aware of. And it again shows really good sensitivity. So a little bit of a small study, but just shows a promise, I think. What do you think, Sarah?
Oh, I think that would, if this could be further validated and further looked at, I mean, the benefits of this could be phenomenal. And, you know, you then wonder, well, actually, could this be then replicated in GP surgeries, for example? Because there's huge burden placed on, you know, bringing people into hospital that, you know, hospital and the emergency department often isn't the right place. You know, it often is for some things. But, you know, helping with those patients, you know, it would be amazing to see some modelling about how many reduced transfers to the hospital, for example, and what the implication of that could be by implementing something like this.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm continuing to work with Jamie in this area, actually, and we're actually implementing this in the northwest of England as a pilot initially.
So it's a watch this space by the sounds of it then, Rick.
Yeah, it is. Plenty going on. And, you know, I think it will be really interesting to see how that gets taken up in practice by paramedics, and whether we can use it with things like shared decision making. There's loads of work still to do to get it working, but I agree with you about the potential. So that brings us to the end of the issue. We've covered all of our four papers. I hope you've enjoyed listening to us. Before we go, it's worth us just saying that you can access our podcast on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts. You can give us feedback on Spotify. I think we said that last time, Sarah.
Yeah, we did. But essentially, you can listen to us anywhere that you get your podcasts. Feedback is always great. And please, if you've got any direct messages, you can get through to me via all our social media channels, which are Facebook and Twitter, or X as it is now. So it's goodbye for me.
And goodbye from me. Take care.